What's dangerous is when that the usness, that story of who we are, becomes defined by a them, right? And this is what's changed in politics.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep values and principles of the people shaping our public life. Every episode, you'll hear someone who has some sort of public voice or platform reflecting on the principles that drive them. This series, we are also talking to people around the themes of my book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times, the chapters of which I have structured loosely and I hope a bit playfully around the seven deadly sins. In this episode, I was looking for someone to speak to me about what I call wrath, which is polarization, division, that growing sense of anger we are being formed into towards people different from us, people who disagree with us. So I was really delighted that Tim Dixon agreed to speak to me. Tim has a long and illustrious career serving with Australian prime ministers, setting up multiple projects, as you will hear. But he is also co-founder and CEO of More in Common. We spoke about that journey that he's been on, why he thinks this issue is central to so many things, and what he's learned about the things that are driving us apart and what might help us turn instead towards each other. There are, as usual, some reflections from me at the end, and I really hope you enjoy listening. Tim, I am going to ask you just, you know, normal chatty warm-up question, which is, what does fully aliveness mean to you?
I love this question, as I love the book. So I think number one, it's to be in relationship, in deep relationship with others, to be known and to know others, to feel valued, a sense of belonging, to share journeys of triumph and also of trial together. I think that you can go through some of the worst things in life, and if you do that in company with someone by your side, that can be, you know, deep, profound, and really sort of fully alive moments. For me as a person of faith, my deepest experience of being fully alive is also feeling connected to experiences of God, which, you know, is kind of both every day, but also there's certainly been particular moments having been part of the Pentecostal tradition. I've two other things. I think being connected to a sense of meaning and purpose in life, I think that that is strongest when it is connected to giving, not just receiving, to contributing to others' lives in whatever way that might be, as a parent or a coach or a teacher or a servant for others or a leader, but really a connection to something bigger, a purpose that's bigger than yourself. And the other thing that I think of, because it really shaped me significantly in my early 20s, is the Csikszentmihalyi, his idea of flow, the sort of the state of flow. Mm. I think that's like the sense of, as somebody who's also always had a very strong vocational pull, that sense of those moments in, you know, sometimes it's work. I mean, he worked with musicians and artists and athletes. But the idea of flow is where you kind of lose yourself in something where nothing else seems to matter, and where you can sustain your attention and not be distracted, which I think is very interesting. He was writing that 30 years ago. That's a much bigger issue in our lives now. That sense of focus, there's a fullness in that. And for me, I think that was thinking about flow was quite decisive in how I then chose my career path. Knowing that being a lawyer was just not going to do that for me, even though I did that, I did it for a few years and I found it valuable, but I really sensed there was something about, there were moments of being filled up and feeling that I was contributing to others and connected to others that then shaped my future decisions.
Yes, beautiful. And as someone who has listened to the podcast, you know what I'm going to ask you next, which is, what is sacred to you?
Yeah, so I think the first thing for me is about sense-making or meaning-making. And if I can just give you some context for it, but to say, you know, the question I ask myself in the work I do with More in Common is a big sense-making question, which is not like I'm starting with one thing, like, oh, we've got to crack down on social media, or we've got to solve, there's a political problem to solve, or if I can just sort of connect everybody socially or whatever. I just start with a question of like, why is society cracking up? You know, why do we feel like it is? And there's just so many, there's interconnecting factors that drive that. But I'd say a second thing is that I'm a natural sort of a builder or entrepreneur. I love to, in a sense, I have run businesses. I started my own business, had a publishing business in my 20s, and I've been involved in different parts of business. But the thing I've particularly done is start organizations that try to solve big problems. And that's, I guess this is sort of, is it a principle? It's a kind of rule of engagement for me. Mm. I think of what's the problem? What can we do about it? What solutions are there? Who's already doing things? Where are there gaps? Who do we need to engage? What team would I build? How would I fund this? What will we call it? What will the brand be? You know, what will it do? And that, so I have that kind of entrepreneurial energy, but I love to build. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I was starting political parties in my own brain and assigning my friends to different roles in my cabinet. So I think I've always had that kind of preposterous sense of, you know, I can build and make something. The third thing, which is really important for me, is not doing things alone. You know, I've started lots of organizations, but as co-founder, I mean, I think I did seven in the 2010s decade, seven different organizations, initiatives, but they're all with other people. There's such a delight in building. I don't have that, you know, individualistic makeup of like, it's got to be, I'm not singing my way at my funeral, or I won't be there at my funeral, I guess, but I hope nobody else does. I just enjoy so much working with others. I'm so conscious of my own inadequacies and the things that things are so much better when you work with others. But also, it's sort of half the joy of when you make something, build something. And one last thing that has guided me always is a sense of brevity of the sort of the shortness of time. And this can sound, I don't know, it can sound a bit tragic in a way, but it's not. When I was 3 years old, my grandmother had just visited and kind of was thinking about her shriveled up face and how, I don't know, maybe I'd had a conversation with my parents about death and I knew she was going to die. And then I was lying in my bed and thinking, well, my parents are also going to die. And then I thought, well, that's kind of sad. What's going to happen to me? And then I had this realization for the first time in my life, I also am going to die. And obviously I was quite upset by this, but it really stuck with me. And I've just always had a sense of, life's really short. There's just kind of not enough time for all the things I want to do. I was very nostalgic at the end of primary school. I created my own cassette tape of my, you know, memories and how what it's like getting old. So I've always had that. And I feel like, you know, I'd love to have 1,000 years to live because there's so many things I really want to do that I haven't yet got time to do. But that's always made me want to make the most, I guess, of and not sort of feel like I'm just spinning the wheels.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would say you've done quite a few things, which we will get on to. But first, let's stay with that little boy and get to know him a little bit. What were the big ideas that were around when you were growing up, maybe in your primary school years?
Well, I think so. My biggest influences were adults around me. I think I consciously sought out mentors. Some of that was because...
As a primary school age child, Tim, you were just like terrifyingly precocious.
Yeah, well, I had...
Did you have a briefcase and a little tie?
I was very restless. And I think of my poor parents who just never quite understood my makeup. And my mother was a wonderful, amazing woman. I mean, she's such a giver. And, you know, after she died, we went through all of her, which wasn't long ago, we went through all of her finances. And it was extraordinary how much money she was given. I mean, you know, her purse was falling apart and she, you know, everything in the house was from the generic from the supermarket. But she was giving away $1,000 a month to different causes on her pensioner income. But she was feeding the homeless till her late 80s. I mean, she's you know, terrific giver, but she never verbalized why. And I was a verbalizer. I needed ideas to fill my brain. And so I sought out, you know, influences and friends. So in primary school, my best friend, his mother was a very strong, opinionated woman. She was a feminist and a communist and an activist. She'd been divorced twice. She had a big hearty laugh, and she gave me the time to talk about politics for hours and hours. Actually, I realize in retrospect that probably half of my friendship was actually with her as much as it was with Stuart, my best friend. But she did encourage me in that interest. That was a really big influence. Just after primary school, my aunt from England, so I was growing up in Sydney, Australia, she came and visited. And she was just a riot. She was so much fun. She was so gregarious and just very interesting in her insights on people and life. And she gave me this challenge. She said, well, you know, if you want to come and visit, you're welcome. If you, you know, pay for your fare, you can stay with me. And so I took that up, that challenge at 11, and I spent 3 years delivering newspapers and mowing lawns and so forth. And I spent 7 weeks at the age of 14 in near Sevenoaks in Kent with my aunt. And that was really influential on me because she opened up a world to me because she had these, I think she also made me really interested in English people and that kind of the quirkiness. I found as sort of growing up in Australia, English people are kind of quite soft in a lovely way and eccentric. And so I think I got a fascination, or kind of maybe an early interest in psychology out of that. Like we wrote a soap opera together about all the people in her life because they were just so interesting. And I think that she probably didn't have other people in her life who were as quirky as I was as a 14-year-old kid.
But there wasn't religion kind of in your family home so much that you...
No, my dad was a vigorously atheistic guy. He had experienced the worst of religion growing up. His father was in the British Army and he'd been in India in the early days of his life, the last of the days of the colonies, and gone to quite a strict military school. He was very, I mean, the only positive thing he could say when I became Christian in my teenage years was that at least I wasn't doing drugs, which, you know, I wasn't particularly trading off between religion or drugs.
Us is not unrelated.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's a real insight from the 2020s as well, because I think we see that more than we did once. My mother did go to church, but like wasn't a verbalizer and didn't bring any of that into the family home. So my journey to faith was a very independent one, and actually came through my interest in politics.
Same old. How did that? That's not people's standard experience of joining local Conservative Party or Labour Party.
I overthought clearly as a kid, but I was very committed socialist, but I found that socialism really wasn't working. And I realized there was a problem about the sort of deep corruption of people once they had power. And so I was kind of still looking to understand. Anyway, there's a group of very radical Christians who just used to do things like stick dollar notes to the ground in the center of like the sort of Trafalgar Square equivalent in Sydney. And they'd burn money. And they were like, they had this message that you could live a life that had nothing to do with money. It was a very radical form of discipleship that kind of had a bit of a Jesus people sort of origins. I wasn't interested in that part of them, but I was interested that they said you can live a life without money, you can work without pay. And I wanted to like do this, you know, subvert the whole capitalist system. So I went and did voluntary work with them in just people's gardens and helping a lot of people with psychiatric illnesses who were being deinstitutionalized at the time. And it was just a moment when I was doing that a guy in his mid-20s, a guy named Malcolm, says to me, just, I don't know, we'd been working for a few hours. I don't understand why at 14 my parents let me do this, but it's like maybe I didn't even tell them. But he says, oh, you know, something about Jesus. And I said, look, I'm interested in the politics of what you guys are doing. I'm not interested in the Jesus part, the religion part. And he said, well, have you ever read anything that Jesus said? And I said, look, I have been to Sunday school and I'm not, you know, I'm not convinced. I think religion is just it's used to fool people. It's this comfort for people when they're going to die. I'm not religious, but I like your ethics. And he said, well, you should just read what Jesus said, you know, and he said, read the Sermon on the Mount. So I read the Sermon on the Mount and then I just encountered this Jesus who was completely different. I had this a sort of animosity or distrust of religion and organized religion. But then I realized I always, from that day onwards, saw Jesus as not, you know, as someone who stood apart from whatever the kind of the religious system. But that was what drew me in.
Mm. You already had a pretty busy life by the time you were 14, what with all that gathering mentors and traveling the world. But you went to study and sort of flirted with law, set up an educational business in your 20s, sold it. Again, high energy person is the vibe I think the audience should be getting here. And then comes this, the call of politics. What was it that made you think, actually, I need to get more directly involved in democratic politics?
Well, I always had an interest in politics, a very strong interest from that influence from my my best friend's mum. I was my nickname at in high school for a couple of years was the Prime Minister, the PM. So,
were you really cool?
I was so uncool. Clearly. I mean, my greatest win wasn't on the sporting field. It was in the debating room. You know, that was my, but I was very fortunate to be in a school where you could do, you could flourish in lots of ways. Not just on the rugby field or whatever. I always thought, I want to do some real things in the world and learn, acquire some skills. I didn't know whether I was directly going to go into politics or not, but I certainly had that interest. When I, in 2001 in Australia, there was an explosive moment around refugees where suddenly the country, which I had always thought was, it was an immigration society. I'd grown up with kids of Italian, Hungarian, Greek migrants, and then, a little later on, a lot of people from Asian countries. As particularly North Asia. And so I just thought that, in a sense, we were becoming more open. We saw the humanity in each other. This was a kind of linear path to more openness. My parents had certain prejudices that I always found difficult. But I just thought, there was a pathway towards us being more grown up. And then suddenly, the most vulnerable people in the world, refugees, were being vilified in an us versus them sort of moment that really, was 15 years before you saw that really take off in Europe. And I was very confused by that. I found it emotionally quite distressing. I was working as a lawyer at the time. And there was just this moment when I was watching all of this stuff. I mean, the language was just so odd and it's so aggressive and it was so dehumanizing to people who were escaping, particularly, Iraq. And I mean, we subsequently went to war to say that we were trying to free these people, but then they were being made out to be, the rule breakers, and it was very, the treatment was extremely, the language was cruel and the treatment was very mean as well. So there was this moment watching this on television where I just broke down. It was just kind of 8 o'clock in the morning. I was about to head off to work. And I thought, I can't stay in this country without trying to fix this and change this. But I don't know how to do that. I don't know why it is that things have become so poisonous. But, politics has got to be part of the solution. So that was a beginning of a journey.
Yeah. And you ended up working for four different leaders of the Labour Party in different roles in those very intense kind of rolling crises situation. I don't really know how adversarial Australian politics is compared to UK politics. From a distance, it looks still pretty adversarial. Yeah. how do you think that time formed you?
I think that I got into that role. Well, I would say, number one, it's incredible privilege to serve in that kind of that role, because you see how all the pieces come together. And you can lose faith in the system, or you can be, I don't know, I didn't lose faith in the system. I just sort of got a more nuanced understanding of how change takes place and the humanity of everybody in the middle of it, all of their vanities and weaknesses, but also their aspirations and the best parts of them. I think for me, I thought I have always had that quite strong sense of vocation that I was describing before. And I thought, this is going to be the pinnacle of it, serving a prime minister, changing the world. And what happens when you work in a prime minister's office is you realise the incredible limitations upon your power. Every person in any role, in powerful role I've ever met, never had a conversation with Vladimir Putin, but everybody I've ever met who's been in a powerful role has commented on this issue of, like, you're so much more constrained than you imagine. But then it made me think more strategically about, I realized when I was in there, this is not the culminating point. Actually, this is a preparation for something else that I will do, which will be where I'll be able to sort of contribute the best. I came very close to getting into Parliament. There was a seat that I was going to run for. I had quite a lot of support for that, but then they changed the boundaries. And then I thought, oh, I'll take a little bit of a break. And I went to New York, and then, you know, events take a different course in life. But it didn't undermine my belief in our capacity to make a difference. It just helped me to see that, you know, there's many paths to that difference. And I guess made me more attentive to how do you, if you're on the outside, so to speak, how do you influence the inside?
Yeah, you're right. That career, that sort of period in your life happened when you were really quite young. And as the sort of smallness of it in terms of your story is really noticeable and unusual, I think. And lots of people spend their careers trying to build towards that point. And I think that sort of talking to Caroline Lucas for an episode this series of everyone involved in that political system, knowing the limitations of it, I think a lot of people come to a similar conclusion to you, which is maybe there's some levers outside that I can pull it, you know, with business and social purpose organizations. And as you said, you set up a lot of those. I think probably we're in the middle of that period of your life when you were getting to know Jo Cox. How did you get to know her?
Well, I had strange, like several connections to Jo. One was I was involved in starting something called the Freedom Fund, which is a fund that works on modern-day slavery. The person who leads that and has done an amazing job there, Nick Groner, is a very good friend of mine. Jo happened to be the first person who worked for the Freedom Fund back, I guess, 2013. I knew Jo's husband, Brendan, from work that I'd done on global poverty. He was working at Save the Children. Then I also co-founded an organization called the Syria Campaign, which was focused on really protecting civilians within Syria. Jo, once she'd gone to Parliament in 2015, was really the biggest champion of the Syria Campaign. And then I was doing work on refugees, and she was likewise, you know, a great champion of that. So it was a very strange situation. So I moved to the UK in 2015, and Jo was the Member of Parliament who, I mean, you know, I come out of a senior role in politics in Australia. There's very strong connections between the Australian Labor Party, the British Labor Party. And when you're in that world, you then kind of, you know, you just sort of come into those networks. But it was just a peculiar thing. Jo was the Member of Parliament I knew best. I arrived in the country, you know, a year, 18 months later, Jo's murdered in the most brutal and awful way. And I was with Brendan at the time when he got the call that she'd been attacked. And everything about that, you know, that day just remains so surreal and awful. But the thing about Jo was an amazing force of nature, an incredibly positive person. And the next day when I was sitting there, you know, in shock with a group of Jo's friends, you know, we sat there obviously in tears and incredible sort of sadness. And then about 3 o'clock that afternoon, we all looked at each other and just had this blinding flash of what would Jo do at this moment? Definitely she'd like be trying to turn the story around. How do we make this not a story about this, the killer or the act? Well, how do we make this a moment of the community coming together? And so we said, okay, we'll do a crowdfunder for her causes and called it the Labor Party. They said, yep, we'll send a message out to everybody on the list. We did that. We had £1 million within a day. George Osborne, who was the chancellor at the time, kicked in a pile of money that he had from a little trust fund, didn't want any attention paid to it, didn't want any plaudits, was just totally genuine about it. So impressive dealing with the number 10 with Downing Street and the Conservatives at that time as well. It was just a moment of really seeing the strength of British democracy and people's ability to rise above the partisanship. And then we did this big event in Trafalgar Square a few days later. It was galvanizing in a positive way. So that was this moment of incredible tragedy, but then also this experience of how, well, if you come together, you can change what these moments of tragedy and turn them around in Jo's spirit. And that the Jo Cox Foundation came out of that, but also it was really the kind of launching pad for More in Common.
So tell me, so you were a serial starter of things and an entrepreneur and have you know, clearly get bored quite easily, frankly, looking at the first 20 years of your career. But more in common, you've talked about as a life thing, as a vocation thing. What is it about that challenge of growing division that has meant you want to put your life into that?
Well, I think I feel very well made for the challenge. Oddly, it was partly actually as I was thinking for this conversation, I was thinking about the first thing that I did in my kind of, I don't know, social, political life as a kind of adult, other than the many causes that I joined as a teenager. The first thing I did was I worked in privacy around, you know, fights around privacy rights. And obviously they're big, very big issues now in the age of, you know, digital technology and so on. It was quite similar to the issues of polarization in the sense that it was a global issue, cuts across lots of different things. One day you're talking about healthcare, the next day you're talking about telecommunications, the next day you're talking about, I don't know, your media. It's always kind of, it's fundamentally about your personhood, what it means to be a person and where you can control information about you, who has access to that, what do they do with it. Polarization's got a lot of those dynamics. It's global, it's complex, it's cross-cutting, it's changing all the time, but it's fundamentally about how we interact with each other as people and why do we buy into a sort of an us versus them way of thinking. So my reflection now is that I think I was doing some similar things very early on, but what drew me into this at this moment was, you know, at that moment, I mean, I think actually you've described it with how you started this podcast, that sort of moment, 2016, 2017, where, you know, we really felt that somehow the ground was shifting. I don't know how, one part of how I describe that, this is that we all seem to get exhausted and triggered and we all seem to be much more on edge than we used to be. I think it's significantly to do with our information environment. Our loneliness and disconnection are kind of the way that we live our modern lives, that we're just a lot less, we have a lot less healthy interconnection relationship with each other, where it makes us also distrustful of each other. That kind of puts us in knife edge, but also there's this all, you know, it's the convergence of those things. There's economic factors, there's sort of the pace of change, there's the whole media environment that's, you know, just giving us different echo chambers and different versions of reality so that we don't even share, have a common story about the moment that we're in. There's all of those things happening. And what is the solution to that? And this is where I feel that my background, because, you know, yeah, I was a lawyer, but if you only train as one thing, you just, it's the old adage that, you know, if you've got a hammer in your hand, everything's a nail. If you're a lawyer, you think like, oh, it's like litigation or it's wars, acts of parliament that will change things. Or if you're in politics, you think it's the government that does it. Or if you're in civil society, maybe it's a campaign. Or if you're very much more community oriented, it's something you do very locally. And those are all parts of the answer, but there's no silver bullet. And I mean, also I think quite a lot theologically, I guess a third of the books that sit around me in my library here, various different parts of that. And, you know, a lot of this, I'm also shaped by thinking about what does it mean to be human? If you're created in the image of God, God is revealed in the Christian story as Trinity, that is like a relationship between persons. We are, and that makes me believe that what it means to be human is to be in relationship. Like that is what defines our humanity. And the polarization we're experiencing is all about dehumanizing each other.
Yeah.
Is going in the opposite direction. So while, I mean, More in Common is not a faith-based organization, we do work in the faith sphere. We're not, absolutely not. There's a handful of us, I guess, who would be sort of practicing people of faith. But it's certainly my perspective is influenced. I draw inspiration and ideas from that worldview as well. So I just think it's that mix of things, and I think it's generational. Like, this is not Donald Trump's fault or Nigel Farage's fault, or, you know, those people are all interchangeable. The conflict entrepreneurs, all interchangeable. Every society.
Conflict entrepreneurs.
Conflict entrepreneurs, people who sort of are making money or fame or, you know, building up their platform from playing up the conflict, from telling stories that are binary stories, this or that, and telling a story of us versus them. It's a big game, conflict enterprise. But, you know, I just think there, if you just, you, one of the advantages more in common, we're in the US, the UK, France, Germany, Poland, and now Brazil. And all of these societies are experiencing very similar fracturing forces as, you know, any country in the world you can choose out. Now, that translates into different institutional and cultural manifestations. Some countries have more resilience to those forces than others, but they're overwhelmingly quite similar. But the thing that we're able to do with our work is to just think a little comparatively. And if something is working in one place, could this work here? Something is emerging as a new threat in one place, well, it maybe we should get ready in other places as well for it. So that's one of the really lovely things about this work in this organization, is just being able to, you know, it's learning. I think intellectually I find it really, you know, stimulating and challenging, because I always feel that I don't really have a grip on it. But that's the sense-making function. You know, one of the most powerful moments for me in co-leading the organization, a year or two ago, we went through a strategic planning exercise, and we were talking about what's the waterways you describe the organization, this thing more in common. And a whole bunch of the staff team said, oh, I think we're sense makers. That's what we are. And that was very powerful. It wasn't me telling them that, but it's very powerful for me, because I felt very seen in that moment, and very much, yeah, this is the thing that I can, you know, I can make a difference.
Yeah. And a lot of more in commons work is very, you know, it's putting out really good research to show actually how out of whack our perceptions of the people who disagree with us are, you know, showing there's a lot more sort of exhausted majority in between the two fighting tribes who take up all the air on any given issue. And then local interventions. But I wanted to talk to you about how individuals can be whatever the opposite of a conflict entrepreneur is. And you've very kindly read the chapter on Roth that I wrote in Fully Alive, where I'm really pulling on this thread of our personal complicity in these dynamics of polarization and division. And some of the things that I found really helpful, which are just coming to understand that humans prefer people like themselves. People like me syndrome is what John Yates calls it. Scientists call it homophily. And I have a friend that I'm getting to know who's become very dear in my life. And last night we sat down and had this hilarious realization that the reason we love each other is that we're incredibly similar. And it's this like deep narcissism in the human condition that we really just like ourselves. And not always. I have lots of friends who are not like me, who I love for reasons. But I think we all have it. Doesn't make us terrible people. This preference for our own image. And the way we can, you know, that when we come to awareness of that, we can keep an eye on it, right? We can think maybe that there's limits to this. And the way that fight or flight works, and in the book, I sort of really unpack how I think the nonviolent tradition, which is used by people of all faiths and none, but many people would trace to the words of Jesus in the New Testament, can really help us. But I would love to hear what you've learned, maybe as a person through working with groups on the ground with more in common. For listeners who are like, yes, this is a problem, but I don't know, I'm not going to go set up loads of businesses and write loads of research reports all over the world. What can I do about it? How can we be becoming more fully human, more fully alive with this particular challenge?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I'm less worried about the people like me. I think there's always a part of us that sort of draws, you know, I know when I did the Myers-Briggs analysis, I was shocked to realize that I was part of 6% of the world. And then I realized that most of my friends were also part of that 6%. So absolutely true, of course. And yeah, but what's dangerous is when that the usness, that story of who we are, becomes defined by a them, right? And this is what's changed in politics, particularly. Not in every country, and I actually think less true in the United Kingdom than it is true in the United States. Republicans, Democrats barely know who they are and what they stand for other than opposition to the other side. So that thing of the drawing the us versus them boundaries, that's the bad thing. So one of the big lessons is how we need to find ways to break down the us versus them. And And a lot of our work is thinking about that. What's the stories we tell ourselves? Where can we find shared identity and common ground that we can shift people towards to think about, you know, even if, I mean, Rowan Williams has a lovely way of saying it, that, you know, we might not have the same words, but we do share the same grammar. You know, so find where that commonality is. I think another dimension that's really important is just a curiosity about where other people are coming from. One guy who was, you know, a mentor in my life that I mentioned before, Dr. Kinlaw, the guy who I had my pancakes with, that time when I first met him, he was like a preacher in a quite conservative Methodist Wesleyan tradition. And he invited me to come back the next day to this conference he was speaking at. And these were like very conservative people, a couple of thousand people at this, I don't know, the Red Rock Holiness Bible Camp meeting or something that sort of felt like it had fallen out of a King James Bible. And I went in there with him. I sit next to him. He's the keynote speaker. And somebody's ranting about something weird on the stage. And I think he was very astute, very kind, very switched on. He leans over to me and he says, it's as if he can read my mind of what I'm thinking about the oddness of these, you know, American fundamentalists I'm surrounded with. And he says to me, you know, these people, they have some strange opinions, but you've really got to understand where they've come from. They've come a long way and they're so open to changing. And it just hit me, as he didn't need to say anything that night. I had already got my lesson. That orientation towards seeing other people as not fixed members of some tribe, but more people who are have their own story, have a place they're coming from, have a place that they're going. And I think substantively on that, just to sort of take it one step further, with Moran Commons' work, we do these mappings. We're very evidence-based. There's a strong social psychology element. We have many academics, terrific people in our team. And we've mapped the values of people in the UK, in the US, France, Germany. We've done big reports in Poland. We've done reports on it. You know, they're sort of a couple of hundred pages long. And if I was to sort of just encapsulate a couple of lessons from that, people are not defined mostly by their politics, but the things, the ways in which they approach the world, their starting points for a lot of the issues are just very different from mine as, you know, a Western, well-educated, professional, you know, fairly cosmopolitan outlaw, journeyed, traveled the world, lived in different places. And it's not just like they're traditional or backwards or left behind or whatever. It's more nuanced. So one of them is most people are concrete rather than abstract in the way that they see the world. If you're well-educated, highly educated, you've got your university degrees, you just think in abstract terms. And that's very different to people who think in more practical, concrete ways. And I think that's a big divide. You know, Brexit debate in the UK often showed that to me. Another dimension is some people are very strong on, they're kind of anxious about the disorder in the world, and they really love an ordered society, an authority that's respected and rules that are followed. And they are very distrustful of other humans. Often they've had that experience for reasons for that. But they just want us all to play by the same set of rules. Now, that's not how I see the world, but it's how, you know, in our mapping of the UK, it's the dominant characteristic for 18%. Another characteristic of a different group is that they're very oriented towards group identity. They need a sense of belonging and a sense of attachment and protection. And if you're well off, well educated, secure, you may not relate to that. You know, we found in our research that the people with the most progressive values are the most secure in the sense that they have least, they just kind of don't get insecurity. So financial security, emotions, whatever it is. And I think it's one big gap between, you know, many of us who probably the kind of people who listen to this podcast too, that so they're different dimensions. This work has just given me more of a way of understanding the starting points of different people in society that is rooted in evidence and psychology, and which actually helps you to come to solutions and answers and see ways forward. And not to think of them in binary terms as belonging to this or that tribe, but more their starting points are different, the way the world view, the way they see the world is different. And we can build solutions if we're sensitive to those people and those starting points. And that's why we do endless running of focus groups to try to elevate these voices of people who don't get heard when the debate is, you know, this very binary debate, often sort of very fueled by political conflict.
Yeah. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about how we change the story that we tell around those differences. Because at the moment, so there'll be listeners who sit in lots of those groups who I'm sure might be slightly triggered even by your very careful and diplomatic way of talking about them, right? Because whenever we hear someone talking who is just obviously not of the same disposition for us, obviously does not have the same starting points or the same sacred values, I think we have a tendency to assume disdain or to assume that difference equals distance or difference equals threat, actually. And that wherever we sit on some of those paths, that the story is so easy to tell, you know, and you alluded to one of the ones that liberals tell so kind of annoyingly and unhelpfully in the political space, which is like backwards or people who are very rooted. I, you know, having talked to people from all kinds of tribes, I think people that the sort of, you know, the sneering about the liberal intelligentsia or the sneering about, you know, people that we just sneer at each other, don't we? We have the tendency to go from, oh, that's different. You have a different set of values from me. You have a different set of starting points to, I respect you less, frankly, is such an easy move to make. And I think it's this relationship between, you know, we're more secure with people like ourselves. As soon as we're not with people like ourselves, we're slightly on our guard. I think that fight or flight goes up a little bit. And what fight or flight does is it shuts down empathy. It shuts down the ability to be curious, makes people much more likely to look like an enemy, much more likely to believe nonsense about them. And so I'm trying to work on actively affirming difference, like trying to counter that story by saying, great, you're not like me. What can I learn from you? How can my strengths and your strengths come together into something really great? If I'm an analytical person, I actually really need the concrete person. If I'm a concrete person, I really need the analytical person. And I think that's maybe what we've lost, the sense, or maybe we never had it, the sense that the differences are not a threat, they're a gift, and we need each other. But all of this othering, all of this triggered, anxious, self-protective tribal instincts in us are getting constantly reinforced. That's not a very coherent question, forgive me, but maybe in your own life, are there postures, practices, rituals that help you now, even in your own team? I'm sure you've got, you know, there'll be lots of people quite like you, but there'll be, you know, there'll be generational differences, there'll be disagreements on some things. What helps us remember that we actually need the difference? It's not necessarily a problem.
Yeah. Well, I love, there's a guy, John Powell, who's on More in Common's board. He's the founder of the Othering and Belonging Institute in California. And John has this wonderful way of saying it, of how we think. He says, you know, the way that we often see the world is, you know, I'm complex, but you're simple. That is, you know, on my side, I can excuse the behavior. You've got to understand where, like my tribe, you know, they do, oh, well, they said that, but it didn't really mean it, whatever. But as for your side, well, you know, the worst version of your side is clearly representative of all of them. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, the media environment we're in, social media, that kind of elevates the most conflict-oriented sort of folks, the people with the most jagged points of view, you hear the most extreme. So, you know, a warrior for a particular point of view. Let's take, you know, Gaza as a good example right now. The most extreme position on Gaza will become representative of one side, and likewise, you know, on the other. We did research around the attitudes of the people, of the public, on the conflict Gaza. This is actually something we did in the UK and in France, and we found that 4 out of 5 of people who are deeply concerned about the impact of the attacks the Hamas attacks on Israeli citizens are also deeply concerned about the impact on people, Palestinians in Gaza. And likewise, 4 out of 5 people who are deeply concerned about the humanitarian suffering, the awful tragedy of what's happening in Gaza, are also concerned about the, you know, horrific killings of Hamas in Israel. And what that tells me is that you've got this debate around us that is so polarizing and so divisive and has made people really, you know, in those communities especially, really turn on the other side and buy into very aggressive rhetoric. But it's sort of coming off a very inaccurate picture of reality that imagines that most people are sort of siding with one group and against the other. Mostly people are not. They're just genuinely concerned about humanitarian suffering and want to stop that. So to me, how I would apply that is just not to believe those, you know, those stories, and to be, I guess I have a different diet in terms of social media is one part of that. But it's also to always approach others who are expressing a strong point of view with my starting point of not going to buy into the idea that even if what you're saying is, is different to my beliefs that, you know, it's wrong or backwards or it's anything like that. And I genuinely mean, you know, I come from one side of politics in terms of my career, but I think conservatives, I'm not a conservative, but I think conservatives have so much to contribute to, you know, asking good questions about what does and doesn't work in our society, in policymaking. I get bored by hearing people who've all got the same point of view or come from the same background as me because, you know, if you just surround yourself with people who are of the same view, there's good psychology research behind this, what happens is you actually end up going to more extreme views. But if you put people with opposite views in a room together and, you know, they talk for a few hours, they actually they form common ground and move towards the center. And that's where, if we can create more spaces where we're actually engaging in dialogue, you know, in whatever part of society and whatever, you know, context of issues where we get polarized and divided, then, you know, there are mechanisms of how you can move towards common ground rather than get entrenched in this sort of trench warfare that's happening on social media all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a sort of mental habits, aren't there? And I've been working on this, you know, it's the heart of the sacred. I've been thinking about it for 7-8 years properly and before that. And still I catch myself telling those stories. You know, the more in common research that showed, you know, whatever it is, 70% of Republicans think 90% of Democrats want no limits on abortion, and the other way around, that the actual understanding of what people think is always massively out of whack. You know, that because the only extreme versions are in the media. So when you meet someone from a different tribe, you've got all this bad data that you're bringing into that encounter, right? That conversation. And I find it in myself, my tendency to label, my tendency to go, oh, of course there are X, whatever, and use that as mental shorthand, assume everyone will know what I mean, you know, and trying to root that out of my language, talking about people in particular and their particular likes, preferences, views, not using this shorthand of like, of course they're this demographic, they're this politics, they're this theological thing, and therefore you know everything about them. It was really salutary the other day because I've been doing a lot of podcasts for the Fully Alive book. And I got an invite from a podcast that I had not really looked into in detail before I said yes to. And then I came to the podcast and I looked, I'm not going to tell you what because I don't want to give away all my tribalisms, but I looked at the profile of the people and was like, oh no, why did I say yes to this? This is going to be terrible. They're going to hate me. This book is not the kind of thing they would ever like. They're probably just going to argue with me. Maybe they've just got me on to try and school me about all the things I've got wrong in the book. I felt this like quite sick feeling in the bottom of my stomach of going into a tribe where I didn't know that I was welcome and where I had all of this set of expectations and presumptions. And it was perhaps the most lovely interview I've done with a person who is from a very different tribe and set of positions from me and was pure delight and, funnily enough, a complex human being.
I want to show you, Elizabeth, you're really modeling this, right? Like, it is rare. And, you know, I guess your reflection in the book about that experience, the kind of the conflict that you have on social media and the how you recover from that, it's vulnerable, but really, really helpful, because I think if you try to do bridge building on social media, that's, you know, it's a fool's errand. Like, that's not the space. You're not rewarded. And the people who are there, you know, 98% of tweets on politics come from 2% of the population. Like, that's not where to find your community. Mm-hmm. But in real people, in when you can give people attention, undistracted, you know, faces and names, people, it's transformational. This is being fully alive. This is how we discover each other in our difference and believing that there's something that I don't know or don't understand about you, and you're a mystery that might, in an hour or two of conversation, really open up. I mean, that's the way to see each other, and it is powerful and transformational. So I think, you know, what you're doing with the sacred, I know it takes energy, I know it takes time, and it takes risk, but it's very powerful to model this to others.
Wow. Tim, thank you so much for speaking with me today on The Sacred.
Great to join you.
Well, what a lovely guy. I think because Tim is, his CV is just very impressive, I would have expected him to be more intimidating, less humble and chatty and self-reflective. I also just have a real soft spot for people who are quite intense, like me. You know, he's really, really thought about these things. He's so great. Yeah, I loved hearing about that kind of youthful entrepreneurial drive. He clearly just has bags of energy. And again, sometimes when I encounter people with that kind of high capacity, I can withdraw a little bit because I am not that high capacity. I really need a lot of rest and a lot of time reading books in the bath. And I'm not particularly driven. But in Tim, it didn't cause me to kind of feel bad about myself or feel judgy. All these reactions we have to difference. Maybe I'm growing. Maybe I'm growing up my soul. It just made me go, gosh, I'm really glad you exist. I'm really glad people like you exist. High energy, you know, can set up so many things and move on. We really do need all these different temperaments as we try and build a just and loving world. Interesting. Connection to God, connection to people, connection to vocation. So similar to the kind of things that I think about fully aliveness being, and a lot of people have said similar things. Can I just say, there's a lot of Christians in this end of this series, and that wasn't really by design. I think I knew Tim was a Christian, but I didn't expect him to want to talk about it so explicitly. All of which is to say, if you're not a Christian, please stay with us. We want to make this a hospitable place for conversations across difference, where people drawing on all kinds of wisdom traditions feel really welcome. And it's really an accident of programming schedules that we've ended up with this density of people close to each other. I also think it's really interesting that his conversion was political. You know, he was drawn to the political outworking of Christianity and the way it had a radical response to money and a radical response to the other and that outsider. It's such a heartening story and such a different story, sadly, from the one we often hear about Christianity in public. The idea that you could see justice being worked out by people who were Christians and being drawn to the faith by that was really lovely to hear. Think about meaning making. You know, what a nice thing to have that sense of yourself and your own vocation. And what a lovely thing to have had that spoken over you by a mentor. So we can have such power in each other's lives to say what we see in people, to say what the gifts that we see in them, to encourage them, to literally put courage into them. I love that Tim went looking for it. I think we could all probably do with a bit more of that. And wanting to be that to each other, to speak truth to each other, to call out the gifts that we see in each other. And I also loved what he talked about friendship. It's just so clear, and I often find this when I'm talking to people involved in social change, how much is never about one person. It's very often about these intellectual, spiritual, missional, vocational friendships, people motivated by the same problem, with the same intuitions of what might help, challenging each other, working together. I'm at the Realization Festival, which is run by a bunch of friends, and I'm connected with that bunch of friends, right? And lots of projects that I come across flow out of friendship when we allow ourselves to let our deep callings and passions and wounds and skills be present in our friendships. I think that can be such a creative thing in the world. He says so much about division and polarization that I'm going to take away with me. And I think the key thing is that we need a story of who we are that's about who we are and not who we're not. that defining ourselves as individuals or groups in reaction against people different from us is really dangerous. And I see that such a lot, but it just requires a lot more work, right? It requires a lot more creativity to go, okay, what are we actually for? Not just what we're against. What is this positive vision of the world that we have? What is this positive vision for our group or our center of belonging, that it's not just avoiding being the bad guys? And the stuff about so much of what's going on is as much about temperament as it is about, you know, the more in common categories are really helpful because they're not left or right or liberal or conservative in any straightforward way. They're about, you know, the exhausted majority and people with strong sense of civic virtue or people, you know, that it correlates a little bit with Jonathan Haidt's things about moral taste buds. And I think you see the way that shows up in political tribes and theological tribes. It's one of the things I'm sort of trying to listen to when I'm here, you know, talking to Peter Hitchens recently, realizing that order and justice and structure are almost sacred to him. And that's what forms his worldview. And for a lot of other people, if freedom is a sacred value, then that will show up in the way they are socially and the way they are politically. And that listening for someone's temperament and preferences and values really helps us understand them rather than trying to put them in a pre-existing box in our heads. Social polarization, that fact that if you put a bunch of people in the room who have the same view, the view will get more extreme, whereas if you put a bunch of people in a room with different views, everyone will moderate their views, really seems an important thing to know. Really seems an important driver of what's happening. I spoke to Eli Pariser quite a few series ago, who was the guy who came up with this term filter bubble. And I think that change in our information environment, herding people together into like-minded news feeds and streams and groups and news outlets, is part of what's driving this increasingly extreme positions all over the spectrum / map / grid. / compass. Yes, lots and lots to chew on. But that's going to be all from me for this episode of The Sacred. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield. Our production team are Fiona Hanscom, Dan Turner, and Amari Yagandran. And we are a project of the think tank Theos. We'd love you to go find out about Theos's wider and larger work. I also really like chatting and connecting with you. I have a Substack, More Fully Alive, at substack.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, although I don't think it's a particularly great place for my soul or my formations, but I'm trying to pull back a bit. And I have a personal website with an email on it where you can find me if you would like to chat. Otherwise, we have our last episode of this series coming up next week on Pride, in which I will be speaking with my housemates from the little intentional community that we live in, around what we've learned about individualism and community and how we move towards each other, not away from each other. I'm really looking forward to sharing it. Until then, I hope you have a lovely week.